Hey folks, Ben Birch here from White Rose Society. I don't usually interrupt your regularly scheduled programming, so I'll keep this brief. I am currently holding a fund drive to keep White Rose on the air. If you think what I do here is valuable, please visit our homepage at www.whiterosesociety.org and chip in to defray the substantial costs of this service. Thank you very much.
Conversation cussing and a discussing with America's only born and bred Southern liberal talk host. Head On with Bob Kincaid is brought to you each night by Coal River Mountain Watch. Coal River Mountain Watch invites you to become part of the solution, part of a sustainable future, part of the uprising against mountaintop removal. Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net. And now, from high in the hills of beautiful West Bicod, Virginia, here's Bob Kincaid on the Head On Radio Network.
Well, howdy! Alrighty, a minute or so past the hour of 6 p.m. here on the East Coast. And we are live, and we are rocking, and we are loaded for bear tonight. I'm Bob. This is Head On, a place that you know that you can come and know that there won't be any BS or any attempts to make things appear what they aren't. Just, oh, this is a place where you can really actually get straight talk, unlike some BS-loaded presidential candidates. You know what I mean. So, sit back, kick back, relax. Your thoughts, you know that, are always welcome. The toll-free number, 877-443-2366. Or if you'd like to save us a nickel or a buck, as Peter Godbold says, you can dial on your own nickel or your own unlimited long-distance dialing plan to 304-658-3333. Awfully glad to have you on board this evening. And we've got some technical changes going on. It looks like they are taking quite well. I had to swap out the machine that carries the stream up to Ben Birch's White Rose Society servers. And unless somebody tells me otherwise, working marvelously. Hot diggity. So let's call this one a win and hope that it stays that way. Oh, let's see. The logical first place to begin this evening would be the Supreme Court decision today, one theoretically at least for our side. But I missed something last night, and I want to start with it this evening. We'll get to the serious stuff soon enough. I hate the fact that I missed this last night. But there were so many people who wanted to say so many things and so much good conversation to have. There just what didn't seem to be room for it. So I'll take care of it this evening. It's a birthday wish. It's a birthday greeting. I'm a day late, but I don't think Ann Royal will mind. Ann Royal, you see, has been 154 years in the grave. But still, it is a birthday worth noting. And, of course, the person who noted it best is our buddy Jeff Biggers, author of The United States of Appalachia, one of my favorite books of the last 10 years. And, in fact, yesterday, June the 11th, was Ann Royal's 200-and-some-odd birthday. Here, quick, do the math. 239th birthday. She's been dead 154 years. Who was Ann Royal? Well, if you go over to Huffington Post and look for Jeff Biggers' posts, you'll see a posting titled America's First Blogger, Ann Royal. And she was. And she is a historical personage for whom I have great admiration. Among other things, she was one of those people that I guess Andrea Mitchell from NBC would have called redneck, bordering on Appalachian. Ew. She was born in Pennsylvania on June the 11th, 1769. She was an indentured servant. Eventually, she married an eccentric planter in what was then considered West South Central Virginia. Now we would call it Greenbrier County, West Virginia. Her husband was older than she and died before her and left her his estate, which was contested and taken from her. She was, in fact, reduced to poverty. She was an autodidact of sorts. What she learned on her own, and she became a writer. She became a writer, quite frankly, on a par with the same level of accomplishment of Mark Twain. Reduced to penury, reduced to poverty by the greedy SOBs who took her legacy, her husband's legacy from her, she took off and decided to travel about America. And among other things, she traveled into the American South and wrote about it. And wrote about it in such a way that many, many people sought to read her writings. By the late 1820s, as Jeff Biggers notes, she was literally the scourge, and this is part of why I admire her so much, she was the scourge of the burgeoning religion industry that sickened this country in the mid-19th century. She wore them out. She was a jealous defender of the separation of church and state. She was a female newspaper publisher. She was a muckraker in Washington, D.C. Politicians of the mid-19th century hated to see her coming with a loathing that is probably greater than George Bush or Dana Perineal have for even Helen Thomas. In fact, Ann Royal is probably the only woman in the United States ever to be actually convicted of being what was called at the time a common scold. Yeah, a common scold. What a woman she was. With no money and nothing but grit and determination, she founded her own newspaper in Washington, D.C. It was called Paul Pry. That was 1831. She gathered to her side orphans and cared for them. She collected donated type for typesetting and typeface. She relied for her income on subscriptions. And it was that newspaper was absolutely a force to be reckoned with in Washington political circles. At one point in time, I believe it was John Quincy Adams, who had wandered down. You got to remember, Washington, D.C. wasn't much back then. He had gone down to go skinny dipping, the President of the United States had, in the waters of the Potomac. And he had stripped off down to his birthday suit and gotten into the water and was splashing about some. When Ann Royal came down and collected his clothing and stood there holding it, informing President Adams that she would be more than happy to return his clothing to him as quickly as he agreed, if I'm getting the story right, to back the funding of a newfangled device called the telegraph. Oh, I just love this woman. Imagine then, if you will, Ann Royal is buried somewhere in an unmarked grave. No, really. Had it not been for Ann Royal's efforts, what Samuel F.B. Morse accomplished with the telegraph likely would not have happened anywhere near the time that it did. Everybody knows the message that was sent on that first the demonstration of the telegraph. It was Ann Royal who got Congress, by virtue of her constant haranguing, her what we would call grassroots activism, got Congress to pass meager and modest funding for the newfangled device. And like I said, everyone who studied anything about any kind of history who is of a certain age and actually had to remember history that was taught to them in school knows that the first telegraph message was, "What hath God wrought?" Oh, yeah, really, the first telegraph, "What hath God wrought?" See, America was born as a Christian nation. That's why they sent that message, "What hath God wrought?" And they never, ever, ever teach what the reply message was. It came from Samuel F.B. Morse himself. Dots and dashes. Sent to him, "What hath God wrought?" Came the response, "And how is Mrs. Royal today?" God had wrought Ann Royal to bring common sense and a new era of technology to America. Somewhere she lies in an unmarked grave. She was among the first of those whom one might call a feminist. At one point in time, one of the fundamentalist religious monsters that inhabited the country at that time, much as they do today, threw her down a flight of stairs. Ann Royal. It didn't stop her. She lambasted P.T. Barnum, wore him out on the pages of her what we would call blog. Wore P.T. Barnum out until P.T. Barnum begged, according to Jeff Biggers, to put the celebrated personage of Ann Royal on the lecture circuit. John Quincy Adams, who had had his clothing taken from him, called her the virago errant in armor. Up out of these Appalachian hills that the likes of Andrea Mitchell find so horrifying and gauche. Paul Pry absolutely blistered the religion industry and made them hate her. She investigated kickbacks. She investigated political nepotism. She investigated the American banking system. She investigated a postal scandal. She investigated the land frauds against the Indians in the South and out on the Western frontier. And why this woman is not celebrated all over this country is beyond me. She is, says Jeff Biggers, an astonishing reminder that in America there are second acts, that in fact her life is an extraordinary series of reinventions at a time when women were assumed to have no control over their destiny. She published her first book at the age of 57. Everything that we're talking about right now, she accomplished in her later life. When the rest of us tend to think of settling down for retirement. What an amazing woman. The Washington Post said of her, 50 years after her death, and still tormented by what she had done to the then for-profit media, said of her, she was a holy terror. Her pen was as venomous as a rattlesnake's fang. Former Washington editress, how Anne Royal made life a burden to the public men of her day. Her fight with the Presbyterians on Capitol Hill, with Indians 15 years. She lived with American Indians for 15 years. And as far into the modern age as 1927, H.L. Mencken, in his magazine The American Mercury, heaped praise upon her and called her the grandmother of the muckrakers. Ain't nothing happens in these hills. Ain't nothing here worth reading about. Ain't no history here worth learning. Why, we're just rednecks. Almost Appalachian. Can you imagine the slap that Anne Royal would have laid across the snide and smarmy face of Andrea Mitchell? Anne Royal would have slapped Andrea Mitchell so hard the spit would have flown. And Lord, wouldn't you love to have been there to see it happen. So you know what? I am proud. You know, if I've ever got the wherewithal to do it, one of the things that I've talked about being an outgrowth of the horn, I would like to start something called the Anne Royal Foundation. Now, don't get all worked up. It ain't going to happen. It's just another one of Bob's big damn dreams. You know, all it takes is money, but that's the lead thing that there's least of. But I would love to start the Anne Royal Foundation. And I would love for that foundation's purpose, that foundation's goal, to be the nurturing of honest, independent, Southern journalism, with an especial focus on raising up journalists, much as Anne Royal raised herself up. And making broadcasters of them. And writers. And personalities. So that they could do in the 21st century what Anne Royal did in the 19th. And blister the hide off of James Dobson. And the Falwell Gang. And the Hagees. And the Parsleys. What I do is probably a poor, poor comparison to what Anne Royal would have done to Hagee or Parsley. Lord, they would have been afraid to go out in public after she had gotten done penning her work against them. Of course, it was their spiritual forebears who threw her down a flight of stairs. Good Christians that they were. Happy birthday, Anne Royal. Until a couple of years ago, when I got hold of Jeff Bigger's United States of Appalachia, I didn't even know you existed. But here and now that I do, a week seldom goes by that in the course of firing up the horn and turning on the microphone that I don't think of you, Anne Royal. And wonder where you lie, and if anyone ever puts flowers on your grave, or in a silent moment says thank you for all those of us for whom you paved the way. I just... And thank you to Jeff Biggers for reminding us of who she was. Thank you to Jeff Biggers. But most of all, thanks. Thanks to Ann Royal. Would that we had more like her. So that's a starting place at 20 minutes past the hour. I hate to keep people sitting on hold, however, so we will go straight away to the phones. Hi, welcome to the program.
Hi, Bob. This is Juanita.
Hey, Juanita. How are you?
I'm pretty good. How about yourself?
I'm getting there. Getting along. Getting better.
Well, good. I'd like to know that woman.
Isn't she inspiring?
I'm telling you. You know, I think there's a lot of that that goes on, you know, that we don't even know about.
Oh, I think you're right.
Of unsung heroes.
Yes. Well, she was certainly known in her day. It's just
yeah.
that we have forgotten her now.
Uh-huh. Maybe
you know,
someone had used her name for a blog or something. You know,
what guts, what courage she had.
Yes, gracious.
She had everything taken from her. I mean, she was dirt poor.
Yeah.
And taught herself to read, taught herself to write, read everything in her husband's library, and then decided she could do it herself.
Wonderful.
Didn't wait for some man to open the door for her. Just went and to look at these preachers, and they were just evangelists, not televangelists of their day, and to have the guts to stand up. But to have the guts to stand up against them and tell them that they were frauds, tell them that
yeah.
they were selling snake oil. Man, you know, if we had 1,000 people with the courage of Ann Royal, George Bush wouldn't go out in public.
Neither to head up Congress.
Well, can you imagine what she'd say about somebody like Nancy Pelosi?
I was thinking yesterday when. Not their name wrong. Sandra, is it Sandra?
Yeah, Sandra.
I was thinking yesterday, I would love to see someone like her in the Congress.
Oh,
I
yeah.
I would love that. You know, every once in a while, we have outspoken people in Congress. I know we had one here from Florida that used to holler and scream and carry on, and I love that. Because, you know, all that little, honorable so-and-so and all that kind of junk.
We have a disagreement, and I wish he would stop being so, yuck. You know,
it's just so phony.
It's phony.
And it's like we're supposed to get away from any royalty. And I love in England the way they do, that guy has to answer some questions.
Yeah, yeah.
Can you imagine Bush trying to answer questions like that?
Oh, he couldn't survive one question time, not
no.
one.
No. I had a few little things I wanted to say. Were talking yesterday about, by the way, yesterday was so great.
Well, thank you.
You were talking about what they're saying about him, Barack Obama not being experienced enough.
Right.
I recall when John Kennedy was running, I can remember things like that. Harry Truman did not want him to run. He asked him to please wait till he had more experience. He felt like he didn't have enough experience. Eleanor Roosevelt was the same way, and she was trying to get Adlai Stevenson to run again. He didn't want to. And about a year after JFK was in office, they both said they were wrong. They were really proud of him. They thought he was, you know, excellent.
Well, the thing about that whole experience business is there is no one out there who can have the experience necessary to be president of the United States, because that job doesn't exist anywhere else. There's no on-the-job training for it, Juanita. What you've got to have is a bright and inquisitive mind and a great love for country. And frankly, given the nature of the process, you've got to have a little bit of a craving for power. No one who doesn't want or yearn for power is ever going to find themselves in the presidency, barring, someone who didn't want it in the first place and wound up vice president and then got elevated to the office. Some say Harry Truman was that way.
Uh-huh. Well, I had another idea, too. I mean, they're not talking too much about who John McCain is going to nominate for or try to get to run with him.
I still say that at the end of the day, it's going to be Jebby. I won't say it's going to be, but I'd say there's a better than 50-50 chance it's Jebby.
Who?
Jeb Bush.
Well, you stole my thunder.
Oh, you think so, too?
Yeah. When I tell you a way it could happen, too, in a roundabout way, is I don't think the man's long for this world, or is... You know, he's looked bad for a long time to me. And I think if they do get him in there, I think it's just for show. I don't think he's going to have any kind of power. And even if he didn't nominate Jeb for his vice president, whoever becomes president, say it's somebody like Charlie Crist, that he might be forced into getting Jeb Bush, and you know, he won't be long for this world either, because Jeb will get it. Jeb will get it in it, one way or the other.
I think you either see Jeb running for president in 2012, or you get him on as a vice president on a ticket somewhere along the way.
Right.
The Bush mongrels, the mongrels from the Bush family, will do anything, Juanita, anything, to achieve and maintain power. And you said John McCain won't have much power. That's probably true. George Bush himself has not had much power, but he has been allowed a great deal of access and access to wealth by virtue of allowing himself to be wielded as power.
Yeah. And another thing, I am so proud of Dennis Kucinich once again. I am so proud of him. And I couldn't find it, the whole thing, until last night. I found it on C-SPAN on the Internet.
Mm-hmm.
The whole thing?
Yes.
And I didn't get to see the last of it because, frankly, I went bedded.
5.5 hours is a long time.
That's what it said. And he was eloquent, you know.
Yes, he was. He's a brilliant man.
He certainly is.
I'd say
he's not presidential. Well, the people that say that would say that about
Well, that's one of those.
Oh, he's too ugly.
That's one of those vacuous, wishy-washy, the dirty mop water terms that doesn't have any substance. What the hell is presidential, Juanita? I mean, I'm not cussing
right
at you. But what, you know, what is that? I mean, if you, according to the for-profit media, whatever presidential means to them, Abraham Lincoln could not become president in the 21st century.
No.
Tall, gangly, ugly, got these things growing all over his face that he has to grow a beard over, and the half depressed half the time, and the uses 8-syllable words, and so no, hell no, he couldn't be president. He wouldn't be president. Oh, well, look
he
at him.
He had a funny voice.
And that stupid hat. Oh, my goodness gracious, he's not presidential, Andrea Mitchell. Oh, I don't think so. He's almost Appalachian.
Yeah.
You know, he was born in Kentucky.
Yeah.
So that's presidential, please. You know, what I want is a smart guy who gets stuff right. And I guess that just puts you and me and most of the Horn audience in a distinct minority. You know, I saw this thing on CNN, and God knows I loathe CNN anymore, but the bit of BS about how many voters judge a presidential candidate by their wives. Which is just sort of the nasty old closet opening up that's got all the ghouls and bats in it that are going to come out and attack Michelle.
Yeah.
because it's already started. I noted that Guy James mentioned Michelle Anchor Baby Malkins.
That was my first time to hear about that on his show.
Yeah, about what? Yeah, baby mama. Oh, yeah.
From her, my gosh, she's trying to be like Ann Coulter, but she
can't. We deport her.
Can't. Huh?
Can't we deport her or something?
Oh, yeah. Waterboarder, maybe.
Waterboarding would work. Yeah, absolutely.
I mean, it's not torture.
No, it's not. It's that's. Well, how many times have we even told? It's just like a little fraternity prank. So I'm sure Michelle. Michelle Malkin would not mind being waterboarded. It's not torture.
Right.
Or maybe give her that thing they call the water treatment, where we fill her mouth up with water and then punch her in the gut to make her swallow it. Ah, just kidding.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm mean. Well, I'm just mean and nasty. That's all.
Yeah. Sometimes you just can't help but think of something like that. You know. It's so frustrated.
Well, the sad thing is, my human compassion would probably kick in. I'd be, oh, stop it! Don't do that anymore. But no.
But Bob, I tried to call in the guy James, and something's wrong my phone or something. But he was talking about people calling one another names, and I know with my accent and all, there's some people that are right wing who just assume I am too. They just assume a lot about me because of my accent. And then you have some Yankees that are closet bigots, and they think, oh, yeah, she's be on my side. You know, sometimes people be talking to you, and then all of a sudden they'll say something, like almost in passing, and you think, what are they talking about? But it's like they think that you're in agreement with that just because of your way you talk.
Sure, sure. It is what it is. It's bigotry.
Huh?
It's bigotry. That's all it is.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah, there are plenty. And just like, for instance, now, I had a friend I hadn't seen in a long time, and just in passing, she said, well, at least my kids didn't marry any you-know-what. Well, I just had a cousin. He's about my son's age, and he's been living with a black woman for 14 years, and she had a baby, and he's had to raise the baby, and she can't have any more children, and they just got married here a month or so ago. And she's really nice. I mean, she's a very nice person. So, you know, they don't know who in their family is doing what either.
Right, sure.
But it's just, I don't know. And who was the one yesterday was talking about the guy asking all his job? That was so funny.
Oh, that was Vince.
Bless his heart. That was fun.
Well,
you run into the stuff like that. And
sure you do. Sure you do.
To church.
And I don't think Vince will ever look at a Frosty the same way again.
Bless his heart. I can really sympathize. I understand. But I tell you, that's where we lose out on talking about your lady you were talking about, that, and then Mark Graves. We lose so much because we don't think anybody else has got anything that's interesting to say. I know my last job was in a retirement home, and we had people in there. We had one woman that worked at the White House. The sweetest person, and they'd run these little monthly newsletters, and they'd tell what the administrator tell what she thought, blah blah. Nobody interviewed those people. Had I been in charge, I would have interviewed them. We had some interest. We had one man that had worked on the atomic thing. You know, the what was that called?
Manhattan Project.
Yeah. And, you know, just a lot of them, these were people who were well off. They weren't like millionaires, but they were well off to live in a place that overcharged them, you know. But anyway, I just thought we miss out. And people are interested. I don't care who it is.
Absolutely. And, you know, you've got to look around to find these people. And when you do, it's eye-opening. Just like what happened to me learning about Ann Royal. You know.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm sorry. She didn't have the silver spoon or silver foot in her mouth of, a Timmy Russert or a Tweety Matthews or God knows, what's his name, Thomas Friedman or any of these other well-moneyed freaks, William Crystal. Yeah. No, all she had was guts and determination.
Yeah.
And a profoundly well-developed sense of right and wrong.
Mm-hmm.
So,
I love people like that.
Exactly. Juanita, it's awfully good talking to you, dear.
You too, and I hope you continue to recover.
Well, thank you. I do too. I think things are getting better slowly.
Little Bobby.
Yeah, that's it. Just me. Ain't nobody but me. Talk to you soon. Bye bye. Our pal Juanita in Florida. Rolling onward. Hi, welcome to the program.
Hi there.
Hey, Susan, what's up?
Well, your story about Ann Royal started synapses going. Now, today, no matter what anybody says, let's face it, there is this wide streak of misogyny that runs down this country's back.
Sure.
If she'd have been a man, she'd be called a investigated journalist.
Hey, Susan, can I put you on hold for just a minute, please? I think I may have a guest calling in here. Hold on. Hi, welcome to the program. This is Bob Kincaid.
Hi, Bob, this is Amy Vosbring in Congressman Kucinich's office.
Yes.
Are we on the air?
You are.
Oh.
welcome to the program.
Thank you. You were asking to interview the congressman tonight?
Yes, I was.
And I'm sorry he's not available tonight. I'd be more than happy to talk to you tomorrow night.
That'd be a great thing.
Okay.
We will be here. And, yeah, I'm sorry. There's no way I could take this call off the air. I apologize.
No, that's quite all right. Yeah. So 6 p.m. Eastern?
Yes, shortly past 6 p.m. That's when the show starts.
Okay, and this is the appropriate number?
It is.
Okay, wonderful. Well, he will talk to you tomorrow night then.
Great. Tell him, please, that we are very much looking forward to it and that I thank him for his time.
Well, and thank you for the invitation. I know he'll enjoy talking to you.
And I look forward to it. Take care and have a great evening.
Yes, you too.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Sorry about that, Susan.
Hello.
This is what happens when you're producer, call screener, show host, engineer, and everything all in one package. Someday when we've got the thousands and thousands of dollars, someday.
Yes, I understand.
But the cat is now out of the bag. We will be joined by Dennis Kucinich tomorrow evening, shortly after the very start of the program, to talk impeachment, and I'm tickled to death about it.
Great. I just love Dennis. Dennis is just so cool.
Well, you know, the fact of the matter is, Susan, I am and have become, by virtue of paying attention, a very, very jaded creature. And I call people hero, or I admire people. The people that I truly admire are a very, very small group. And Dennis Kucinich is one of them.
Dennis is in that group.
And he's high on the list. So
yeah.
This will be, I guess, our fourth or fifth conversation overall, and I'm really looking forward to it. So now you know what to put on the show post for tomorrow.
That is assuming the website comes up.
Oh, it will be. I had an email from John, and he says it's giving him fits, but he will, if he has to hair lip everybody in New South Wales, he will get it working.
Poor John. Anyway, the thing about Ann Royal really connected because, you know, First of all, like I said, if she had been a man, she would be called one of the first investigative journalists.
Yes, exactly.
But because she was a woman, she's nothing.
Right. Elizabeth Cady Stanton insisted that tribute be paid to her in the voting rights movement. She was somebody in her day. But you know what?
Yeah.
Here's the sad fact of the matter. And it's a reminder for all of those of us in the 21st century that some things don't change. She had to beg and borrow and scrape and live by subscriptions just to get the facts out. When all the Tony highbrow, hoity-toity, bespoke suit, Savile Row, the silk-stockinged crowd were, you know, eating good and printing milk toast journalism, which is a lot of, you know, that hasn't changed either. There was never a golden age of American journalism. When they were doing all of that.
That was the other thing I was going to mention.
She was starving. Yeah.
I would like to borrow a term from the civil rights movement to describe dear old Andrea.
Yes.
Uncle Tom.
I don't necessarily buy that.
I would.
No, she's part of the crowd. She's not Uncle Tommen. She's not trying to ingratiate herself with people above her station. She is in that group. She is.
Yeah, but you see, the thing is, as a woman, she's not really. She may think she is, but she's not really. They'll dump her on her butt at the first sign of trouble.
Well, she's been with NBC for an awful long time. I mean, I'd imagine she's probably vested with her pension or her 401k or whatever it is. Because she's not a spring chicken. And she's well connected.
Yeah.
Although I think I made a mistake. I think Sandra and I made a mistake. I think it's Sally Quinn who's married to Alan Greenspan. I got to thinking about that later, and I think, yeah. But Andrea Mitchell is not. No, she's not part of the beans and cornbread crowd by any stretch of the imagination.
Oh no, but you know, if you're willing to sell out everything you are, to me, you're an Uncle Tom. I don't care what sex you are, what race you are.
Yeah, but you see why I'm saying the metaphor doesn't necessarily work, because she hasn't sold out anything. She is part of that crowd. She is part of that element. Whether she is female or male, she moves in those circles. It's part of that. You know, she said, what did she say? She said, after she said, this is rednecks, bordering on Appalachia. This isn't Northern Virginia, the high technology corridor. You know, this isn't where the nice people live.
Yeah.
Frankly, I would can her for that comment alone. I'd say, okay, sister, you've had a nice run. See you later. Okay. I was wrong. The ELO in the chat room's telling me that Andrea Mitchell married Alan Greenspan in 1997. Okie dokie.
Oh, God. Now, that's a conviction right there.
Alan Greenspan, who had a terrible, terrible crush and perhaps even a romantic love affair with Ayn Rand.
Oh, God. Yeah, that's just gross.
Yeah, it is.
The thought of being connected with him at all just, I'm sorry, I just can't handle that.
So, but if I was Barack Obama, and I was talking with, I was emailing back and forth with our buddy Tosh today, one of the many who listen but don't call, because they listen in delay, podcast archive, that kind of thing. But I get a lot of cool email from him. We were talking about how would you use what Andrea Mitchell said, and I said if it was up to me, everywhere that Obama went into this country that has people in it, like Andrea Mitchell said, I mean, these are not his natural allies. I would have a TV or a big screen or something so I could play that clip and say, listen to me, people. I'm not standing for you. I'm standing with you. And I'm standing with you against bigotry just like that, because your neck may be red and your skin may be white, but you know what? She hates you as much as she hates a black person. We are in this boat together. It's not black against white, male against female. It is working class people against the Andrea Mitchells and the for-profit media in this world.
Yeah. Oh, I like that.
And I would play it everywhere, and I would make a point of going up hollers and telling people that.
Yeah.
Because you know, the way it works here, you know, almost Appalachia. The way it works here is if you tell somebody, it'll get told again and again and again. That's why the, you know, he's a Muslim and wants to take the oath on the Koran thing got started, because they heard it in the pulpit of the church and they got and their Sunday school teacher emailed it to them and they take it for gospel and away they go. Well,
yeah,
the
grapevine gets it.
Right. Or what Jimmy Buffett called the coconut telegraph. I guess up here it's the I don't know, the ramp vine teller, whatever, but never, yeah, I can't figure it out. But you get the idea.
Yeah, he needs to let people know that, hey, these people may look down on me, but they also look down on you, and that puts us in the same boat.
Right. And that's how you create that sense of camaraderie and that sense of common purpose.
Yeah.
And I'd love to see him do it. I would love, because what I describe that as, there's an athletic metaphor, and I think I've said it before, when the guy on the other team says, well, we're going to mop the floor with them, the coach of the opposing team will put that on the bulletin board and make everybody look at it on their way out the door. And they'll look at it every day before and after practice, and they'll look at it on the day of the game when they go out to the field. And it is called bulletin board material.
Yeah.
And that's what Andrea Mitchell just handed to Barack Obama. And you can't buy that kind of stuff. So.
And it's incredibly effective, too.
Yes.
Because nobody likes being dissed. I'm going to do some more research on Ann Royal. Is it spelled A-N-N-E or A-N-N-E?
A-N-N-E-R-O-Y-A-L-L.
Cool. I want to find out more.
And she authored books. Like I said, her first book was published when she was 57 years old. Travel logs. The name of the newspaper was Paul, P-A-U-L-P-R-Y, Pry. And I don't know if the stuff is extant in the Library of Congress or where Jeff Biggers found his information, but I'd love to sit down and read some of her actual words and read what she said, blistering these fundamentalist freaks that she had to deal with. So there you have it.
Yeah, it would be fascinating.
Yeah. I'll bet you if when you type in Ann Royal in the Google, one of the first things you run across will be Jeff Biggers' recent column. And it's a good starting place. And he's got a lot more details in the United States of Appalachia, too, than just what he put in the blog post.
Yeah, I'll have to get that from the library.
Yeah, see.
Anyway, I assume you've got Blinky, so I'm going to let you go.
All right, well, you have yourself a wonderful evening, Susan. I'll look forward to tomorrow. And
my love to Agnes.
All righty. And hey to Donald.
Okie doke.
Bye now.
Bye-bye.
So there you have it. I feel kind of bad for doing that to Congressman Kucinich's assistant. It was the only way. Sorry. You know, it would be nicer if we had other alternatives, but, you know, we don't. So that's how it works. But we will have Dennis Kucinich on at the very beginning of the program tomorrow evening, and I hope you will join us for it, and I hope email your questions. Whatever. I'm sure he'd love to answer them. And we have also received confirmation that we are rescheduled for David Sirota on Friday the 27th of June. I'm very much looking forward to talking to David about his new book, The Uprising. because I read that with rapt attention in the week, finished reading it during the week that I was not quite myself, or my insides were not quite themselves. I was still me. They weren't. I think there's a lot of information, and, you know, if you're a book-buying, book-reading kind of person, I highly recommend purchasing it. I think there might even be an Amazon link on the website somewhere, and if you go through that, we get some small percentage of the sale price, and that's a way to help the horn. But now, what I was saying to Susan is abundantly true. Perspective, every now and then, I need a dose of perspective, and Ann Royal provided me with one. Because she was saying and printing things that desperately needed printed, and she was busting her butt for a technological breakthrough that frankly runs straight from Samuel F.B. Morse to you and me sitting here, me talking talking into the computer and you listening from it, and the phone calls you make, and the emails you send, and the blog posts you create. There's a direct connection between all that and Ann Royal. And she died broke. She died poor. That's why she's in an unmarked grave, folks. Because just then as now, her side didn't have the common sense to support her efforts. And so it was left to people who subscribed to her newspaper, Paul Pry, to help her keep her head above water. And you who contribute to and support the Horn are the modern-day progeny of the same people who contributed to and supported people like Ann Royal. And while you are, as Shakespeare said, a few, a happy few, you are head and shoulders above the likes of Andrea Mitchell or Tim Russert or Tweety Matthews. You are head and shoulders above Katie Couric and Charlie Gibson and Brian Williams and Britt Hume. There is not a one of those people I have just mentioned who is fit to sit down at your table and dine with you. Because you are interested in facts. You are interested in more than just what the for-profit media wants to spoon-feed you to keep you in the dark, well, to make a mushroom of you. See, that's what the for-profit media does. They're in the mushroom business. The for-profit media is interested in keeping America in the dark and feeding them nothing but shit. They are in the mushroom business. And you don't like it. And I don't like it. And so you come to a place like the Horn, and you get relief from the garbage that flows out of TVs and across newspaper pages. You know, our good friend Eugene Finnerman over at FinnermanWorks.com had a posting a couple of days ago talking about what Stephen Zell is doing to the Chicago Tribune. Stephen Zell is taking over the Chicago Trib, which was never exactly a bastion of liberality as far as I can tell. And he has declared that very soon that newspaper will be 50% content and 50% ads. Because for Stephen Zell, it's not about journalism. It is not about fulfilling the duties and obligations of the Fourth Estate. It is about the opportunity to make a, come on, where's the word? You know the word. Profit! And public trust be damned in the process. Eugene's comments were quite humorous, as they always are. If you haven't subscribed to his blasts, you should. It doesn't cost you anything. You'll get every day, or sometimes even twice a day, your RDA of irony in your email box, and you will be glad for having done so. If you were listening to Guy James this afternoon, you heard Dan Rather's address to the Media Reform Conference. and the truths that he spoke and the facts that he gave. Now, what you probably haven't heard, because I haven't gotten the audio yet either, and when I do, I will make a point of running it. What you haven't heard are the words of our buddy Joe Bagent. And it's fine words that Joe, because like Dan Rather, like Bill Moyers, Joe was invited to the Media Reform Conference this past weekend in Minneapolis. And his remarks, and you can go and find them at joebagent.com, B-A-G-E-A-N-T.com, joebagent.com. His remarks are titled Breaking the Beer Barrier. God, I love Joe. He began his address by saying, hello, fellow members of the liberal media conspiracy. I'm happy to be here at the annual gathering of our secret cells. Oh, Joe. Here's my question, he says. Why can't progressive media ever learn to communicate in redneck and born-again Bubba? He says, I would guess that a lot of you are thinking, why would anybody want to? One answer is the election of George Bush, but there are many others. For example, a third of all Americans live in the geographic South, and over 50% live in the cultural South, which is to say places with white Southern Scots-Irish values, places like Western Pennsylvania, Central Missouri, Southern Illinois, Eastern Connecticut, Northern New Hampshire, and others we never think of as Southern. When you look at people in what has come to be called the Red State Heartland, most of their values are more or less traditional white Scots-Irish values. He's got a point. He says, much talk as there is about these fellow Americans, particularly during election season, most liberal and alternative media never speak to them or for them, and that's a shame, because when we do that, we abandon the project of equality for all Americans, some of which happen to hunt, fish, drink Bud Light, and enjoy NASCAR, Bon Jovi, and Toby Keith. And I'm even guilty of it. I'm trying to catch myself when I feel that coming on. Now, I don't think Joe would disagree with me if I said when I say that some of them are beyond the pale and some of them are beyond reaching. But there's no harm in trying to learn to walk the walk and talk the talk. Now, you know what? There's a lot of people who never will. There are people who are so far removed from that mindset that they just can't get it because they've never been around it, and they think of it like they think of a trip to the zoo. Andrea Mitchell's comments come to mind. Joe's comments are brilliant, and I do encourage you to read them. He said, well, you can read as well as I can read to you. But this is brilliant stuff. Our urban areas are not the only places exploitation occurs, and people of color are not the only people being exploited, just the most obvious. I've always thought that we'd all be better served if our news media centers were moved out of Washington and close to working-class America to Keokuk, Moline, or Birmingham, someplace undistorted by the Washington power buzz, New York ambition, or Los Angeles glitz. Actually, Joe says, New Orleans wouldn't be a bad choice these days. He says, getting back to the leftnecks, though, there's another great term, leftnecks. I'm a leftneck. That's what I am, by God. I'm a leftneck. Getting back to the leftnecks, though, America's media cast is put off by the way these folks look and sound and their unpredictable opinions, which do not conform to standard ideology or political correctness. I say give them a voice, even if it happens to make you wince due to your own social and political conditioning. Let a working man speak. Tough, free-thinking carpenters and truck drivers, give them the mic. Let them talk. They know how to speak to their own people and can show all of us a thing or two about how this country really works. American media is more than happy to deal with the rural red state working class as long as it remains conceptual and in the abstract. There you are, Andrea Mitchell.
Why that, Bristol, Virginia? It's those are rednecks. It's bordering on Appalachia.
As long as it remains conceptual and in the abstract and out there somewhere in the heartland, a place to be polled and surveyed by Gallup to fuel the communicating class's self-absorbed political abstractions. Instead of daily reports on class issues, as we said, are the true basis of all politics, the people get reports on the economy. I gotta suggest to Joe that he adopt our... He says, so what we have in mainstream media, for-profit media, Joe, I think you'll like it a lot better. What we have in the mainstream media is a societal caste of middle-class disseminators granted entitlement to be the one voice describing America in political abstractions to the many, which in itself is weirdly authoritarian. And they maintain that entitlement as long as they maintain fake objectivity and throw around enough data to sound informed. And as long as they do not mention that socialism is the fastest growing political affiliation in our hemisphere, which it is, and as long as they never quote Chavez or Castro in context. Our entire mainstream information format is fraudulent. For instance, every daily newspaper in America has a business section, but none of them have a labor section. Let that one sink in. Every newspaper has a business section, but not one single paper has a labor section. Any given community in America, who do you reckon there's more of? Business people or working people? You know the answer, and so do I. He also says even alternative news sources get sucked along into the backdraft of meaningless mainstream media controversy at the expense of useful exposition of truth. For example, if you really want to inform the public in a useful way, you don't ride the Reverend Wright story to death, commenting and counter-commenting on a story purposefully set up to paint Barack Obama as an angry black man. The time and effort might better have been used to examine the common political interest between blacks and working class whites. Instead, we got punditry and academics being interviewed about the role hick racism will play in Obama's presidential campaign. Just gorgeous. Just gorgeous. Go read it. I try to hit Joe's site two or three times a week, just because the letters he gets from his own readers are astonishing, just amazing, and so very smart. So you know that's the first hour. And I hope the next two will be as engaging. I'm all, you know, psyched. I'm definitely stoked for tomorrow evening. Because, well, getting to talk to someone who's serious about honoring the Constitution and honoring his oath to the Constitution is a damn rarity, okay? It just is. And maybe it will inspire some people to, pull an Ann Royal and make their own members of Congress miserable until they stand up and honor their oath to the Constitution. Because, see, that is an unassailable position. If you've got a congressman who won't support impeachment, you ask that person, why will you not honor your oath? Why will you not do that one thing which, above all, you were sent to Washington to do, and that is to honor and to support and to defend the Constitution of the United States of America. Indeed, indeed. So we'll take a little break. We'll come back with the second hour. and your thoughts. Your phone calls, 877-443-2366, or on your nickel, 304-658-3333. This is America's listener-supported liberal voice. This is the front line in the fight against right-wing hate. This is The Horn.
It wasn't perfect, they fought and died. 200 years of struggle for equality. Now we look more like a monarchy. The halls where justice did once reside has been sold out and replaced with lies. It's all money, power to the few. How long until they come for you? And you say that it can never happen here. And you say it can never happen here. Burn habeas corpus, tear up the writs, rubber stamps, Senate of hypocrites. Those new detention camps weren't built for show. Posse comitatus is next to go. And you say that it can never happen here. And you say that it can never happen here. Fear rules a mob. You print your truth, you lose your job. The thing won't make it safe for you. It's death for many, riches for the few. And you say that it can never happen here. And you say
it's your second hour in the Liberal Sandbox, and you're head-on with Bob Kincaid.
Truly, John Koontz wrote an anthem for our age, didn't he? It Could Never Happen Here, from the album of the same name. John Koontz, K-O-N-C-E. The whole album is that good. And supposedly there's a new one on the way sometime soon. I'll let you know when it happens. Hopefully we'll get John back on the air to talk about it. Great guy he is. All right, second hour. New topic. Oh, Lord, please don't. No, that sounds like the McLaughlin Group or something equally loathsome.
New topic.
But seriously, new topic. And it's what I mentioned at the top of the program. It is the ruling from the Supreme Court of the United States today They got one right. Hallelujah. At issue today in the ruling, the right of inmates at the Guantanamo Bay concentration camp to challenge their detention in the court system of the United States. What would seem to be a no-brainer to anybody who was paying attention in first-year con law in law school, and even some who have just bothered to read the document without the schooling. No-brainer. But if you recall our conversation about this time last week, the thugs in the Bush administration are not actively involved or engaged in following the Constitution. They're actively involved in the creative legal frauds requisite to circumventing the Constitution. And hence you wind up with a concentration camp at Guantanamo Bay. By the way, there's another language moment. Jesus, if only we had a few million listeners. But you know what? You can do it yourselves. Just a few thousand of us. Several thousand of us. Many thousands of us, actually. We can do it. If you'll put it to use. Put it in your emails. Point it out. It is not the Guantanamo Bay prison camp. It is the Guantanamo Bay concentration camp. See, most people, it couldn't possibly be a concentration camp. Only Germans do. Only Germans and Japanese people. Only people we don't like, only people we're at war with do concentration camps. BS. We do them too. We've got one at Guantanamo Bay. We've got one at Abu Ghraib. We've got probably two or three more inside Iraq. We've got one at Bagram Air Base near Kabul in Afghanistan. And they are concentration camps. I mean, hell, the Orwellian name of the concentration camp at Guantanamo alone should be enough to set the little light bulbs a blinking for you. Camp Justice, kiss my butt. Camp Justice. Arabs go in and they never come out. It's the Jihadi Motel. That's the way they like to think about it. But look up, do it for yourself. Don't rely on me. Look up the definition of a concentration camp and see if it doesn't fit. You've got people of one race, one religion, one outlook, and they are concentrated in a camp. You know, a concentration camp does not refer to the fact that you sit around and play the home game of the home version of the old game show, concentration. I need A3 and H2. No, no. Oh, we have a match. No. And it's not concentration in the sense of focusing on a topic. It is a concentration of one type of human beings. Whether it be Americans of Japanese descent, or whether it be, in the internment camps of the Second World War in the United States, or whether it be Polish Jews at Auschwitz, or Sobibor, or Bergen-Belsen, or Treblinka, or Dachau. It is a concentration of similar situated human beings. And what is happening at Guantanamo and Abu Ghraib and Bagram and all the other places and the hell ships that ply the seas, whether it be the USS Peleliu or the USS Bataan, those are concentration camps. And so there was, in fact, a decision on a legal challenge brought by internees at the Guantanamo Bay concentration camp. And it resulted today in a 5-4 decision with Kennedy, Ginsburg, Stevens, Breyer, and, oh, come on, Souter, siding and creating the majority. Writing for the majority, Justice Anthony Kennedy said the following. This is a direct quote from the opinion. The laws and Constitution are designed to survive and remain in force in extraordinary times. Liberty and security can be reconciled, and in our system, reconciled within the framework of the law. That's fancy legal speak for what you Bush bastards are doing is unconstitutional. The issue today was the right of detainees to contest their imprisonment and also to challenge the kangaroo court rules, the star chamber. It's not even a kangaroo court. It is a court of star chamber that have been set up to, in advance, to try, convict, and execute them. We know from the pronouncements, General Hartman? Yes, General Hartman. We know from the pronouncements of General Hartman that even if under the BS Star Chamber rules that are set up for these show trials at our concentration camp, even if the guy wins, even if the defendant is acquitted, they feel no compunction to turn him loose. You see, the idiots and the America-hating, unconstitutional, constitution-loathing subverters of the Bush administration got on the back of a tiger, thinking it was a pony, and now all they can do is grab the ears and the tail and hang on. Because there's a whole bunch of people, and a whole bunch of people have been and have gone through Guantanamo's concentration camp, who were not terrorists, who were not enemy combatants. You recall the fact that we put out a bounty of some $5,000 on anybody in Afghanistan and would take anybody's word for it and just round them up, shoot them up, fire them up with the funky drugs, knock them out, diaper them, and fly them from Afghanistan to the concentration camp in Cuba. No, really, that is what we do. And they weren't terrorists, many of them. We got one tourist, no, really, a T-O-U-R-I-S-T from Germany. Others were goat herds and simple people, hill people, from up the holler in somewhere in Afghanistan, who were ratted out by their neighbor who wanted their pasturage, or ratted out by their neighbor who just thought it would be convenient to get the $5,000. And they went to Guantanamo, and they were not terrorists. But in the course of being there, an ember glowed in their breast, and that ember sparked the tinder of their souls, and the tinder conflagrated into a full-blown terrorist revenge urge that suffuses their heart, their mind, and their very being now. So that the Bush administration feels they can't let them go. And they feel they can't let them go because if they do, they will tell the world what was done to them at the concentration camps that the United States maintains. And once they're done telling the world what was done to them, the fire that burns in their breast will be ignited in the hearts of millions more Muslims, Pakistanis, Arabs, Persians, Iraqis, Jordanians, Syrians, Lebanese, Egyptians, Malaysians, Indonesians, wherever the word spreads of the war against Islam that George Bush started travels. The Bush administration has created in its concentration camp at Guantanamo Bay nothing short of a breeding ground for revenge against this country. For revenge that will be meted out not against George Bush or Condoleezza Rice or Donald Rumsfeld or Robert Gates or Paul Wolfowitz or Edelman or Cheney or any of the freaks. It will not be meted out against them. It will be revenges meted out against your sons, your neighbors' daughters. Because the nature of revenge is not that old proverb, supposedly Sicilian, that says revenge is a dish that is best served cold. Because that indicates a level of patience and calculation. This is going to be white hot revenge. And it was created by the Bush administration. And they recognize it. And they know now that the people released from the concentration camps have the power to fuel a fire that can set ablaze the entire world. Hence the need to maintain those concentration camps in perpetuity. Oh, George Bush, I'd like to close Guantanamo as soon as we find countries that will take these people. The hell's wrong with sending them home?
We can't do that. They might be terrorist cells.
Yeah, because you made them want to, you dumbass. Ah, what a tangled web we weave when first we trifle to deceive, eh? But that was the ruling today, that these prisoners do have the right to challenge their detention in the concentration camps, and that they do have access to representation, and that they do have a right to challenge the courts of Star Chamber set up for them, in which they are defended by lawyers who don't have access to the evidence necessary to mount a credible defense. Under the rules that were established for the courts of Star Chamber at the concentration camps, any lawyer mounting a defense would de facto be committing lawyer malpractice because he could not mount a properly prepared legal defense simply because the information is not allowed to be passed to the defense counsel. What was the story a couple of days ago? We found, you know, more and more comes out. It's just drip, 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 until it's going to become a flood. We found out that the interrogators, otherwise known as the torturers, at the concentration camp were told to destroy their notes of the torture sessions so that defense lawyers couldn't get their hands on them. You did wait, just let that one sink in for a minute. The guys and girls, gals, ladies, what? No, not ladies. The men and women doing the torturing and doing the interrogating were not allowed to keep the notes of the sessions. And yet would be allowed on the stand to repeat hearsay of what the person being tortured said, with no means of refreshing their recollection. And no means for defense counsel to challenge the recollection. In short, the torturers at the Court of Star Chamber could simply get on the stand and make stuff up out of whole cloth. Oh, yeah, he said he wanted to destroy America, and he was a terrorist, and Allah was great and would knock down America, and he wants George Bush's mama to have a piano dropped on her head, Your Honor, and I so help me God. How the hell do you cross-examine that? You don't have anything to impeach the witness with. Well, the court's decision today says that there is a right to challenge. Now, the dissent in the case was, of course, lodged by the usual suspects. Fat Tony Scalia, Uncle Slappy Thomas, Samuel Alito, shoot him in the back, Gomez, shoot him in the back! And John Roberts. Speaking for the court, Fat Tony Scalia, son of a man who swore an oath to Mussolini, said that the majority's decision warps our Constitution, which just beats the daylights out of me how. But he doesn't have to say how. He's bitter and he's hateful. He is, in fact, a fascist and feels no compunction at, again, just like down at the concentration camp, making stuff up as he goes along. So he just says, "Wow, this warps the Constitution." And Slappy Thomas says, "Sure does, boss!" And Samuel Alito says, "Absolutely. I was talking to my wife the other day. We were at lunch, and she was wearing that lovely suit that she wore to Congress for my confirmation hearings when she broke down and she was crying. You know, the suit that looks like the upholstery from a 1959 Edsel. And she said, 'It'll certainly warp the Constitution, Sammy.' And I said, 'You betcha, baby!'" Yeah. Fat Tony Scalia also said that the nation will live to regret what the court has done today. Well, Fat Tony, the nation has already lived to regret 99% of the decisions you've made, so I guess a little bit more isn't going to change things very much now, is it? The nation will live to regret what the court has done today. Thank you, Il Duce. Now, I am quoting here from the CNN story. I despise milquetoast journalism, you know that. The CNN story didn't have the nerve to print what it was, the really hateful part of what Fat Tony Scalia said. Because again, Fat Tony is bitter and fascist. And what Fat Tony said was that America is at war with radical Islamists. Our armed forces are now in the field against the enemy in Afghanistan and Iraq. The game of bait and switch that today's opinion plays upon the nation's commander-in-chief, listen, will make the war harder on us. It will almost certainly cause more Americans to be killed. Really, from the bench, this man who imagines himself a superiorly intellected jurist, a veritable Solon for the 21st century, with no legal backing, with no legal grounds, with no legal support, simply asserts that affording the most basic of legal human rights to the internees at a concentration camp will almost certainly cause more Americans to be killed. The nation will live to regret what the court has done today. Jiminy Christmas. And you know what? He's praying right now that it comes true. And so is Sammy Alito, and so is Slappy Thomas, and so is John Roberts. They're praying that somewhere out in the red state heartland, some radical Islamist will walk into a Walmart and set off a bomb. They're praying for it. They're aching for it. They're yearning for it. Because then Fat Tony Scalia will be a prophet. He will have upon him, on his filthy opus dei flesh, the hand of Almighty God, placing in his mouth the words of truth. And he can say, I told you so. I told you the Constitution shouldn't be allowed to get in the way of our ability to put these people away, these radical Islamists, for the rest of their natural born days in a camp somewhere, so that eventually their minds would just disappear into a fog of mush inside their heads, and they'd sit there and just wish every day that they was already dead and that we would just go ahead and execute them. I told you this would happen. Oh, he was outraged. And he said that his predictions of dire consequences were a departure from my usual practice. Oh yeah, this is some of the most sleazy, filthy, anti-American garbage that I have read in a long time. Because if just one of those little backpack bombs can go off in a Walmart somewhere out in the heartland, then finally the fascist bastards can close their fists around the American throat and put freedom to bed once and for all. What it means is that American liberty sleeps with the fishes. Yeah, really. Don't get after me. No, this is not anti-Italian bigotry. Now stop it. That's just how this guy is. You got to remember, he was raised by a man who swore an oath to Mussolini. No, really. He hates our constitutional form of government, Tony Scalia does. He despises the wild freedoms that come with living in a republic based on democratic principles. He loathes them. He looks for ways around them. He looks for ways to kill the Constitution a little bit more. He looks for ways to make the rights that appear in the Bill of Rights go away. Today, for the first time in our nation's history, the court confers a constitutional right to habeas corpus on alien enemies detained abroad by our military forces in the course of an ongoing war. The Chief Justice's dissent, which I join, shows that the procedures prescribed by Congress in the Detainee Treatment Act
provide the essential protections that habeas corpus guarantees. There has thus been no suspension of the writ, and no basis exists for judicial intervention beyond what the Act allows. My problem with today's opinion, hey, give me a cannoli, would you? Is more fundamental still. The writ of habeas corpus does not and never has run in favor of aliens abroad. The suspension clause thus has no application, and the court's intervention in this military matter is entirely ultra vires. That's Latin, you know. I shall devote most of what will be a lengthy opinion to the legal errors contained in the opinion of the court. Contrary to my usual practice, however, I think it appropriate to begin with a description of the disastrous consequences of what the court has done today. Polly, get off my car! I'm telling you, Polly, I see you on the car again with you. America is at war with radical Islamists. The enemy began by killing Americans and American allies abroad. 241 at the Marine barracks in Lebanon. Oh! Oh, stop it, Tony! Jesus, you low-rent thug. Come on, Tony. Why were 241 Marines killed at the barracks in Lebanon? Come on, Tony! Tell us why, you son of a bitch! Tell us about how they were safely billeted aboard ship offshore from Lebanon and could easily reach any trouble spot, any hot spot, by helicopter. Tell us about it, Tony! Tell us about how Ronnie Reagan said, I want to put him on the ground in the barracks there in Beirut so we can show the flag. But you don't have the guts, you thug. 19 at the Khobar Towers in Dahran, 224 at our embassies in Dar es Salaam and Nairobi, and 17 on the USS Cole in Yemen. On September 11, 2001, he's not even into the second paragraph before he has to start waving the bloody shirt of September 11th. On September 11, 2001, the enemy brought the battle to American soil, killing 2,749 at the Twin Towers in New York City, 184 at the Pentagon in Washington, D.C., and 40 in Pennsylvania. It has threatened further attacks against our homeland. One need only walk about busted and barricaded Washington or board a plane anywhere in the country to know that the threat is a serious one. Yeah, Tony, we know how freaking serious the threat is. It's so serious that women are forced to drink their own breast milk, that people with piercings are forced to remove them from, women with piercings are forced to remove them from their nipples, that grandmothers wearing underwire bras are felt up. Yeah, that's a serious threat, dear Tony. Tell us how serious the threat is some more. Our armed forces are now in the field against the enemy in Afghanistan and Iraq. Last week, 13 of our countrymen in arms were killed. The game of bait and switch that today's opinion plays upon the nation's commander-in-chief will make the war harder on us. It will almost certainly cause more Americans to be killed. That consequence, that's going to be war if they do that. I swear, it's going to be war among the families if they do that. You watch.
No. That consequence would be tolerable if necessary to preserve a time-honored legal principle vital to our constitutional republic. But is this court's blatant abandonment of such a principle that produces the decision today? The president relied on our settled precedent in Johnson versus Eisentrager when he established the prison at Guantanamo Bay for enemy aliens. Citing that case, the president's Office of Legal Counsel advised him that the great weight of legal authority indicates that a federal district court could not properly exercise habeas corpus jurisdiction over an alien detained at Guantanamo Bay. Had the law been otherwise, the military surely would not have transported prisoners there, but would have kept them in Afghanistan. Transfer, maybe, you know, maybe in one of those shipping containers they got over there. I hear those things get awful, awful freaking hot. They get awful hot, Tony. What do I got to do to get the cannoli? Come on. They would have kept them in Afghanistan. Transferred them to another of our foreign military bases. Turned them over to allies for detention. Those other facilities might well have been worse for the detainees themselves. Those little Islamo-fascist punks ought to get on their knees and kiss our feet for how good we're making their lives at Guantanamo. That's what those little vermin ought to be doing. You hear me? They're lucky we ain't whacked them. In the long term, then, the court's decision today accomplishes little, except perhaps to reduce the well-being of enemy combatants that the court ostensibly seeks to protect. It's going to get worse for them, I tell you. It's going to get worse. At least 30 of these prisoners hitherto released from Guantanamo Bay have returned to the battlefield. Some of them's been captured or killed. Others have succeeded in carrying on their atrocities against innocent civilians. In one case, a detainee released from Guantanamo Bay masterminded the kidnapping of two Chinese dam workers. Nah, I didn't say it. No, they was working on a dam. And they're not dam workers. Well, they are Chinese dam workers, damn Chinese. But they were Chinese workers who were working on a dam. Chinese dam workers, one of whom was later shot to death. He got whacked when he was used as a human shield against Pakistani commandos. Another former detainee promptly resumed his post as a senior Taliban commander and murdered a United Nations engineer and three Afghan soldiers. Then another one, he murdered an Afghan judge. We can't have people going around whacking judges. What do you think? It starts in Afghanistan, it winds up here. Next thing you know, I'm going out to start my car in the morning, and boom, why do you think I have Paulie start the car every day? It was reported only last month that a released detainee carried out a suicide bombing against their Iraqi soldiers in Mosul, Iraq. Yeah, yeah. See, that's what happens when you let the other family's soldiers go back. You got to take care of them. You got to finish the job, if you know what I mean, you know. I mean, just saying. Yeah, it's hush-hush on the QT, but you finished the job. These, mind you, were detainees that the military had concluded were not enemy combatants. The military, no less. Their return to kill illustrates the incredible difficulty of assessing who is and who ain't an enemy combatant in a foreign theater of operations where the environment does not lend itself to rigorous evidence collection. Astoundingly, the court today raises the bar, requiring military officials to appear before civilian courts and defend their decisions under the procedural and evidentiary rules that go beyond what Congress has specified. Like the Chief Justice Dunn said, you know, the boss, the capo de tutti capo. Like he done said, we ain't got no idea what those procedure evidentiary rules are, but they're going to be determined by civil courts
and will be more detainee friendly. You can't play patty cake with these tugs. You can't let the other family's lieutenants just walk the streets. You gotta make them pay. If they impose a higher standard of proof from foreign battlefields or, you know, sheep herding fields than the current procedures require, the number of the enemy retained to combat will obviously increase. But even when the military has evidence that it can bring forward, it's often foolhardy to release that evidence to the attorneys representing our enemies. What do they think they are? They got a right to a fair trial? They got a right to a fair execution. That's what they got a right to. They got a right to be charged, they got a right to be tried, and they got a right to be executed. That's how you gotta deal with these punks. One escalation of procedures that the court is clear about is affording the detainees increased access to witnesses and to classified information. During the 1995 prosecution of Omar Abdel Rahman, federal prosecutors gave the names of 200 unindicted co-conspirators to the blind sheik's defense lawyers. That information was in the hands of Osama bin Laden within 2 weeks! 2 weeks! That's what I mean. You gotta have wartime consiglieres defending these punks. And they gotta know that if they do too much defending, well, you know. Don't start your car yourself. I mean, you know, it's just common sense. In another case, trial testimony revealed to the enemy that the United States had been monitoring the cellular network. Yeah, they didn't know it before that. Because they're stupid. Yeah, what are you, stupid? Yeah, they're stupid. They couldn't imagine that we'd actually be able to listen to their cell phone calls. But they found out, whereupon they promptly stopped using it, enabling more of them to evade capture and continue their atrocities. Dear God. This guy is honest to God. A hater of the Constitution. A hater of American liberty. The nerve of him to say that a principle like habeas corpus doesn't apply to an alien. Remember, he's an originalist and a strict constructionist. But if you ask him what it means, they like to go running off to the Federalist Papers and find some hateful piece of crap written by Alexander Hamilton to justify what they said, justify what they want to decide. Well, this man can't bother to find the correspondence of Thomas Jefferson saying that, of course, habeas corpus as contained in the United States Constitution has to apply to aliens and foreigners. Otherwise, it's no good at all. No, he can't be bothered with that. He has not a shred of evidence to suggest any support for his hateful writing. He just says it, and in saying it, makes plain what he yearns to see happen in this country. Because it won't happen to any of his loved ones. It'll happen to some redneck out in the heartland. It'll happen to somebody who might not vote the way that Fat Tony thinks they ought to vote, if he thinks they ought to vote at all. Because remember, he's created an entire class of people, you know,
like 94-year-old women who have voted in every election since 1933, who don't have birth certificates and don't have driver's licenses, and just got disenfranchised like the little old lady out in Arizona. Yeah, it happened. Voting is something that Fat Tony Scalia is none too crazy about. Nor is the Chief Justice. Nor is Sammy Alito or Slappy Thomas. No, none of them. But CNN, in its wishy-washy journalism, can't quote and shine the light on what that fascist thug Tony Scalia says. Oh, yeah, somebody's going to get hate out of this. No, they try to paint it pretty. Try to make it special. Try to make it tolerable. There was no Australian in that dialect. What are you? What's wrong with your ears? Quit that. Welcome to America. A little blow was struck for freedom today. Because eventually, you see, Guantanamo is a petri dish. Whatever they can get away with at Guantanamo against people who are not Americans, these fascist thugs will eventually try to get away with against American citizens. Yeah, that's why one of the counts of the impeachment articles that Dennis Kucinich brought forward included a violation of the Posse Comitatus law. Because eventually, that's where it'll go. It'll be aimed at American citizens. Anybody, because if you can, do you see the progress? Do you see how the progression works? How you can go from saying, "Well, yeah, I can do it," to, you know, it's almost like a perversion of something out of the Bible. If we've done it under the least of one of these, we can do it also under the citizens. You know, I got a link earlier today to a story that claims, and it claims that American soldiers are being queried as to whether or not they would be willing to fire on American citizens. And it came from Prison Planet, Alex Jones. And I don't maintain a very high opinion of what happened, what goes down at Prison Planet and Alex Jones, because this particular story said that the journalist writing the story said, I got an email from a guy who works with a guy who says that they got the word from a guy who was hired in a program who said that back in Iraq they were being at. Count the hearsay. There's about 3, 4, 5 levels of hearsay in the assertion. But the claim being made that American soldiers are being trained to think that it's all right to fire on American citizens. I don't know whether it's true or not. I'm inclined to believe it, but see, there's that hateful word, believe. I despise believing. I praise and I reverence knowing. But believing is suspect because it's happening not in your brain, but in your heart. I'm inclined to believe that there are elements within the United States military who would ask soldiers whether or not they would be willing to fire on their brother and sister Americans. It's not that far a reach. But the journalist in the story at Prison Planet didn't do journalism. He didn't drill down and find the source of the allegation. and as such, left himself open to charges of wild-eyed speculation and just plain old-fashioned making crap up. I'm sorry, I'm that way. I've got to have facts. I've got to have something sourceable. Because I'm not going to sit here and hustle conspiracy theories at you. Even if the Bush administration is one great big wad of conspiracy theory, I'm not going to do that because that reduces me to their level. What we talk about in this program, we talk about in terms of things that can be verified physically, technically, logically, mathematically, scientifically, epistemologically verified. Would American soldiers fire on American citizens? I got no doubt at all. Hell! Tell you what. But again, it's speculation. What do you think? You want to speculate a little bit? Shall we play the speculation game in hour three of the program? We can if you want to. But I can provide you some circumstantial evidence that I think that you will find a little less than reassuring. We'll do that. We will indeed. And we'll take your phone calls. We can do that too. We certainly can. You know the phone number. 877-443-2366. 877, the numeral 4, head on. Or on your nickel, 304-658-3333. This here... Well, you know, this here is the horn. We'll be right back.
I'm moving out. that's moving up than I'm moving out.
Tonight's final hour of Head On begins now. 1-877-4-HEAD-ON. That's 1-877-443-2366. Here's Bob.
Hey, knock wood, he said, rapping his skull gently. All the technical modifications seem to be working like a charm. What we needed was a hard drive with a faster I.O. connection. And a hot-to-trot processor. And the former Beast machine has gone into duty as the streaming machine. And, yeah, do it again. Okay, maybe not my head. Let's lean over the table here. It's really made of wood. God, I'm such a superstitious freak. It's working beautifully. So hopefully some of the problems that have beset us in terms of problems with the archives and the podcasting are now no more and forever in the past. Let me know if it's otherwise. Now, we've got a lot of, with what we can, we try to go forward. And we've got a lot of modifications that we continue working on here. You know, we still have sincere hopes of getting into a new studio. I'd said by June. June didn't happen because, money wasn't there. But we do have hopes of building the new studio. And if you're interested, we hope you'll be part of that process. And like I said, there is no one prouder than I am to stand shoulder to shoulder with those who choose to help keep independent, honest, forthright conversation going on the horn to battle the. And you know, let me just reemphasize this for a moment. I mentioned it last night in our conversation with Sarge. Every day in America, there are 2,570 hours of right-wing hate radio. Say it again, Bob. 2,570 hours. How many hours is that, Fat Tony? 2,570 hours of right-wing bilge that pollute the public airwaves of this country. And it appeals to about 5% of the population, if I recall my numbers correctly, from a conversation with Mark Levine. 2,570 hours a day of right-wing filth to satisfy a market that is comprised of 5% of the American people. And I'm just the kind of stubborn, cantankerous, crotchety, middle-aged, incredibly pale person who thinks that's wrong. And hence, I and Wayne and Agnes
ideaed up the horn. And then others came along. Ben Birch said that he would make the streaming happen. Because no one out there has done what Ben Birch has done to try to stem the tide of right-wing hate that fills America to the brim every day. So Ben Birch said he would make it happen on his end. And along came John Fox. And at the time, our still dear friend Bruce Birch. Along came Joe Vecchio. Along came Peter Godbold and Mark Levine. Guy James joined in somewhere around March, I think, of 2006. And we have done what we can do to try to fight back against those 2,570 hours with whatever hours of normal, sane conversation that we can produce. And the fight is carried out in other places as well. Nova M. Air America used to try, but I think they've given up for the most part. And you can get some liberal ha-has from Stephanie Miller. And you can, if you've got, see, Ed Schultz don't do it for me. I don't think Ed Schultz is a liberal, so I don't count him in the little band of brothers. And all of us have to go around with our hat in our hands. And it's frustrating. I want to send thanks out to Jim for stepping up and standing shoulder to shoulder with us with a contribution toward keeping the horn going last night. It was a surprise and it was a pleasant one. And it gets us a little closer to halfway to our monthly goal, which is still sort of in the red anyway. But it gets us a little closer and it makes it a little more likely that there will be a July for the horn, and in August. And for that, we say thank you. And thank you to all of the band of brothers and sisters who continue to fight those 2,570 hours. If you want to be a part of the fight, it's as easy as clicking a PayPal button at headonradionetwork.com. You can sign up for a subscription, whatever you can afford to share. Or you can make a one-time contribution, too. There's buttons there for all of it. You can use snail mail, if you choose, to Head On, 1038 North Eisenhower Drive, PMB 318, Beckley, West Virginia, 25801. All of both ways goes to help keep things happening. And I can never say thank you enough. And I try to make sure that I say thank you more than I say please. So thank you one and all. I was alerted to something that Rick Goodner said in his program last week, Rick's Place, and went back and re-listened to it. He said if I had heard it running live, I would have stopped it, but I wouldn't have stopped it. Rick put out an impassioned plea for folks to support the horn. And Rick himself has done a lot to support the horn. You remember that he put forward some of the funds to get the studio started, the new studio, and the things that have to go into the studio. So thank you, all of you. You few, you happy few. You are doing a great load of work for a lot of thousands of people. And if all the thousands of people who listen to the horn would do what you do, I wouldn't have to do this anymore. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. No, I said before the top of the hour that I had some circumstantial evidence of the direction in which this country is headed. And I do. Oh, there's, you know, the fact of the matter is there's tons of circumstantial evidence if you just care to look for it. There is no No lack of it at all. In fact, speaking of horn psychotherapist Rick Goodner, I fired this story off to him a little bit ago. Stories that have a psychological angle I send to our horn psychoanalyst, because I figure somewhere along the way he might want to chime in. You never know. This is definitely one of those Rick Goodner, white courtesy phone, Rick Goodner, white courtesy phone moments. An Associated Press story from Oceanside, California. Jesus. Hard to swallow, telling you. On a Monday morning last month, highway patrol officers visited 20 classrooms at El Camino High School. The purpose of the visit was to say, was to tell the children horrible, earth-shattering, heart-rending news. The highway patrol officers told the children in those 20 classrooms at El Camino High School that several students had been killed in car wrecks over the weekend. Classmates bawled. Classmates wept. Some even became hysterical. I can't imagine that. And it's not because they're kids. You're adults. How would you respond? You know, I don't know if she's listening, but our official teen blogger, Cassie, how would you respond if a state cop showed up in your classroom and just told you that several of your classmates had been killed over the weekend in car wrecks? Think about that. Think about the trauma of that. Think about the fear. Think about the grief. Well, the highway patrol officers let it lay that way for a few hours. And then the teenagers were told that it was all a lie. It was a hoax. It was fake. It was phony. It was a rube job run on a bunch of impressionable teens. And not only was it a rube job run on a bunch of impressionable teens, it was run at the connivance of the school officials themselves, who then involved the state police in their hoax. The purpose was to dramatize the consequences of drinking and driving. You see, the seniors were getting ready for their graduation, and graduations are often followed by parties. I remember one. Out in Goods Field. It was a hell of a party, too. El Camino High School is in a prosperous suburb of San Diego. And the school officials are defending themselves, saying it was proper. Michelle De Gracia is 16 years old. She was in physics class when the cop showed up and announced that her missing classmate David, who was a popular basketball player, had died instantly. See, they didn't just say some students. They gave the students names, people that they knew. Her buddy David had been instantly killed after being rear-ended by a drunk driver. She said she was nauseated, but that she was too stunned to cry. They got the shock they wanted, she said. Some of the students got so immediately upset that the teacher couldn't stand it and told them right off the bat that it was all phony. And then, as one might expect, the students started screaming at the teacher. This is sick.
I mean, this is psychotic sick. This is take the sociopath who did this and put them in one of those funny white jackets with the sleeves that tie in the back, put them in a rubber room with a purple crayon between their toes and let them write on the walls. Crazy sick. And I don't know who I don't know who I despise the most. The school officials that came up with this dodge, or this highway patrolman who are sworn to protect and to serve, who went along with it. Personally, I think the cops ought to have their badges pulled. You know, let them go be a security guard somewhere, Walmart maybe. And the school administrators, the school officials, who came up with this, ought to be never allowed around children again. This is no less abusive than if the school official had gone up and gotten a good grope on one of the girls that they were terrorizing. This is abuse. If Children and Family Services found out that there were parents out there mind-screwing their children this way, don't you know that in an instant, I mean a flash, I mean a New York minute, those children would be pulled from that home and put into foster care pending a full investigation? Hell yes, you know that! Twenty-six deaths they dummied up. And a lot of the students were left in the dark until the 26 students showed back up. Carolyn Magus is 15 years old. She said, "You feel betrayed by your teachers and administrators, these people you trust. But then I felt selfish for feeling that way because, I mean, if it saves one life, it's worth it." Jesus criminy. Stockholm Syndrome. This is what happens in an authoritarian fascist state. This isn't liberal thinking. This isn't progressive thinking. This isn't compassionate thinking. This isn't Christian thinking. From the appearances, they recruited the kids to participate too. There are 3,100 students in that school. The officials, like guidance counselor, Jesus criminy! Guidance counselor Lori Tauber helped organize this piece of sick psychological abuse. She said, "They were traumatized, but we wanted them to be traumatized. That's how they get the message." And see, next week I'll be sitting down with them and helping them pick colleges.
The Oceanside School District is the school district in question. The superintendent of the Oceanside Schools is Larry Perondi. He said he'd only had a few calls from parents. And the PTA chapter. PTA chapter said it hadn't heard any complaints. And he said the program would be revised. But he wouldn't say how. And he said he was glad that students seemed to have gotten the message. He said, "We did this in earnest. This was not done to be a prankster." Yeah, but you know what? If a couple of wise-ass kids had put up a video on YouTube saying something like this, their asses would be in suspension yesterday. Wouldn't they? Hell yes, they would be. I hope somebody sues. This is the intentional... Jesus, this is the straight out of the first year law school torts textbook, intentional infliction of emotional distress. I remember, Bob's story time, I remember being a teenager myself. I remember leaving, I was privileged. I got, you know, when we finally got two cars, once in a while, I got to drive to school. School was 2 miles from home, so, you know, long drive, yeah. But 2 miles is no guarantee. And I was giving another kid a ride. We were in our, oh gosh, I think it was a 1977 Ford pickup truck, Ford Ranger. And I was pulling out of the parking lot at the high school, and I had looked both ways. Pretty good driver, even then. And one of my classmates, who had been cutting class, came howling around a blind turn that ran in front of the school, doing about three times the 25-mile-an-hour speed limit, and T-boned me. Threw me into the windshield, broke my glasses. My glasses cut into the space above my eyebrow. You know, honest to God, I still pick little tiny pieces of glass out of that scar above my eyebrow. It's like a third eyebrow is what it is. Well, you know, it goes with my, you know, the Buddhist third eye. And my passenger, in the sort of, you know, free fall, zero gravity sort of a situation, while I was being thrown forward into the windshield, and right before we were, truck got picked up, thrown sideways into the lane of oncoming traffic, and then we got head on. I'm lucky to be here, really. And while I was flying into the windshield, my passenger was shooting across behind me, getting his head put through my driver's side window. Everybody was okay. Off to the hospital, off to the emergency room, got stitched up, got most of the glass, not all of the glass, taken out of my eyebrow. Got a really, really bad muscle strain in my back that crops up every now and then. And went home, sitting on the couch. And a very, very dear friend of mine, who is still a very, very dear friend of mine, had heard the rumor. Because a rumor had gone like wildfire. You know, Bob's dead. And she came a-flying over to the house to see my parents, who answered the door. And I was sitting right in front of the door, you know, watching TV and probably, you know, doing early work against my insides by eating a bag of Cheetos or something. Bless her heart, she turned white as a ghost, about fainted. I thought you were dead. But I wasn't. And when I showed up the next day at school, that happened several times over. Thought you were dead. Thought you were dead. Thought you were dead. You're not dead. I wanted you dead. Yeah, everybody's got an enemy or two. But a lot of people were made upset by, and that was just a rumor based on something that really happened, a car wreck. Here, however, there's no reality to it. It is just an intentional act designed to hurt children. And you know what? A free society, a society at liberty, does not do this to its children. Only an authoritarian-based society does this to its children. Let's go to the phones. Hey, welcome to the program.
Hey, Bob.
I conjured you.
I'm sorry, sir, but I've heard this, and I'm going to have to disagree with you. I think this would really work. There's a real good psychological reason for it. And I think they need to expand it. They need to teach girls about the danger of date rape by taking them out, giving them the drugs, and raping them. Doesn't that make just as much sense?
Isn't it the same thing, Rick?
It's the same thing. You mind rape them, are you? Physically.
Rape them.
Same thing. This is unforgivable, and I cannot believe no one is throwing a fit about this. If that was my kid...
Well, the students are pissed.
I'd be dragging some state troopers out and talking to them.
I can't make any of this make sense. I mean, even where I grew up, you know, Alabama, there would have been an outcry about this.
Well, you know, I was born in a small town. And if you wanted to, you could take your kid up to the sheriff, and he would throw them in jail for you to teach them not to be bad kids.
Yeah.
Well, you know, that was declared illegal.
Well, okay, more stories from my tortured past. 10th grade, you took driver's education.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? And, you know, we had the simulator out back, you know, and you learned to drive a four on the, you know, the column H shifter, learned to do, you know. Yeah, because there were a bunch of those cars. Yeah, I think the simulators were made, like, you know, by Henry Ford himself. But anyway, part of driver's education was watching the horror films, and you know exactly what I'm talking about, don't you?
Mm-hmm. Oh, absolutely.
Yeah, it's a horror film, and they show the bloody bodies at the car wreck scene and, you know, severed heads being pulled through shattered windows and things like that. And everybody goes, oh, yeah, because, you know, it's 10th grade, so 9th grade, you're already, okay, next year you take them driver's ed and you're going to watch the gory horror movies. And all the 9th graders are going, cool.
Mm-hmm. What they don't seem to understand is this is called desensitization. They are taking them and they are keeping them from being, they're sensitizing them to the horrors. Therefore, you're more likely to do it than not do it. If you've been thrown into the jail by the sheriff and you said it wasn't that bad and you met some cool people, what's your chances of trying to stay out of jail? You know, I'm not saying that this is going to help. You know, it's going to make people want to drive faster. I'm just saying it's stupid.
Well, see, I got a question that just rolled in, and I think it'll resonate with you, Rick, because I remember you and I talking, and I think you did it on the air. It was a situation that you yourself had dealt with. I remember you talking about a suicide in one of the schools there near where you are.
Right.
And I believe you said that the first thing you did was you went to the school and said, for the love of God, don't have a mass memorial service and a school assembly or anything like that. Didn't you tell me that?
Yes, I did, and I was overruled by guess who?
Superintendent?
The guidance counselor. Who, by the way, doesn't have any degree in counseling. They counsel on how to get jobs or what school you should go to.
and then that in turn had negative consequences, didn't it?
3 suicides. Yeah.
Jesus. Well, see, I got a question. I got a question here that just rolled in from a listener. What if a grief-stricken kid went up to the second floor roof so as to join their departed friend? How would that be working out?
And how would it not happen? Let's say that grief-stricken friend happened to be a girlfriend of one of the guys, supposedly the guy did, who just went out that morning. She's pregnant. It could happen. Now, who would be guilty? No, it was just a horrible situation that happened. She was already depressed. We just didn't identify her soon enough.
Oh, Jesus. Oh, you mean they even plead pre-existing condition on teenagers now?
Oh, good Lord, yes. They're not going to take any responsibility. The Highway Patrol is not taking any responsibility. The guidance counselor is not taking any responsibility. The school administrators are not taking any responsibility. The kids overreacted.
You know, this guidance counselor, Lori Tauber, they were traumatized, but we wanted them to be traumatized. Somebody needs to slap her till the spit flies.
She needs to be taken in and taught what trauma is.
You know, maybe she could just sit there and guidance counsel at a very, very busy emergency room for 3 or 4 weekends and see the real effects.
Oh, she'd be suicidal. No. This just doesn't make any sense at all. It makes no sense at all. And I don't know why these people seem to put themselves up as experts. You have these pro professionals, let's say, but mostly we were talking school teachers and the cops making decisions that are affecting young minds and affecting, and you know, I'm looking now, okay, are we talking nightmares? Are we talking that people are getting separated and they're not being close to each other for fear of losing them later? They've already experienced the trauma and pain of losing someone close to them, imaginary. But what your brain hears and what your brain feels is true. It doesn't know the difference between the truth and a lie.
So what you're talking about here basically are the sequelae of post-traumatic stress disorder.
Absolutely. You got the beginnings. Once your brain has heard it, it's true. It doesn't matter if they come back and say, oh, no. Think about it for a second. Your kid brother, I assume you had one, I don't know if you did, maybe kid sister. You're walking in late at night and they jump out of the closet and they scare you. How many hours does your heart beat fast?
Well, yeah, it's the same. You wake up from a nightmare gasping.
Mm-hmm.
Because that nightmare was as much reality as you had in the world while you were asleep.
And this is even more reality because you have school officials who you're told to trust and police who you're told to trust and a guidance counselor who knows what's good for you. This is real. And your brain doesn't know the difference between real and fake anyway. It can't tell the difference.
And the human brain doesn't stop maturing until, what, age 28 or so?
27, 28. Exactly. And so you're taking that.
And the thing is, this is not just one person's bad idea. This was the bad idea of the school superintendent. This was the bad idea of the school principal. This is the bad idea of the school the guidance counselor. Every single teacher in this 3,100 student school was in on the fix. And then the state police, the highway patrol are in on it too. And not, I mean, Rick, what the hell? Not one single human being stands up and says, wait a minute, people.
Yes. Okay. Well, let me tell you a little story around here. They decided they were going to have accident trauma stuff like this too around here. And of course I said, okay, you can't do this, can't do this, can't do this. Fine. Okay. I really disagree with kids having to go to the mortuary. I disagree with that. I disagree with the parents having to come and looking at their kids at the funeral home. I don't think that that's necessary to teach kids, and I'd really prefer if y'all wouldn't do that. Matter of fact, I am saying don't do it. Guess what they did?
They did it.
And guess who was called in? Because three of the parents are sitting outside crying, knowing that their kid's in there, still alive, but they can't walk through the door thinking.
They can't look at that picture.
Absolutely. Because what the brain hears, they believe. The brain believes, even if it knows it's a lie.
Well, you know, Rick, another account from my life. That's all I got to rely on, really.
Yeah.
I was 7 years old when my older brother was killed. He was killed via a gunshot wound to the head. And I answered the phone when the call came through. We were in Alabama. This happened over in Atlanta.
You did not tell a seven-year-old.
Well, no. Son, is your mommy there? Yeah. I put mommy on the phone. And they told her, and she called my dad who was at work, and then boom, bang, you know, we were gone. We were away to Atlanta. And so there was no body identification, but there was a file. And I wasn't supposed to see it, but the file was opened, and there was a photograph of my brother with his head turned to one side on a white pillowcase at the emergency room with his brains coming out.
Right.
Every so often, Rick, I still see that in my dreams. I'm a 45-year-old man.
Sure you do.
And
because the fact that it was a trauma, it's going to embed itself into your memory anyway. And then you see something that you only see in horror pictures, and it embeds it deeper. And you are a seven-year-old child. And I don't care what answers mom and dad gives you. They're not answers. So, yes, of course you still see it. I'm sorry. Please go ahead.
Well, no. I'm trying to point out this is not poor, poor, pitiful Bob. This is some evidence of the reality of the subconscious, of the psyche, if you will. I mean, does this make sense? And
yes.
And so, you know, you're right. Nightmares. This is in the same vein of, you know, don't drink and drive. You know, they didn't say that the kid was drinking. The one kid that got told, she was told that the kid was rear-ended by a drunk driver.
Right.
Which of course makes the fraudulently dead teenager of an innocent victim.
Right, right. I get introduced to the concept of wrongful death. Wrongful death is when someone died because of somebody's stupidity and negligence that should not have died.
Right.
And that's the hardest to accept. You know, it's hard to accept the death of someone you love. But if they were too young, if they were innocent and a speeding car did it, a wrongful death, it's something you don't get over in the normal course. You need some help with that.
And in an America where our schools are strapped for cash, where teacher salaries are not where they ought to be, where football programs take precedence over physics programs.
Right.
Where grief counseling is not readily available. They do this. I mean, this is. Tell me if I'm wrong, Rick. This is sort of an invitation for another Columbine, isn't it?
It's certainly an invitation for. Wow! Think about this for a second. Look at everybody crying because George had an accident and got killed. And you know what? I've been pretty sad lately. And as I'm driving to school, I keep thinking, well, I'm just going off this cliff here. And now, look at everything that they got. Look what everybody was doing for all those hours. They can do that for me for real. I'm driving home right now. Bang. Yes, they can push them over the edge. And I would like to know if there's a suicide or a few suicides on account of this. If they won't connect it, they probably won't even report it.
But I mean, I'm guessing about the laws of the state of California, but somewhere along the way, I'm guessing, except there would be some legal wrangling involved that would probably get them off, I'm guessing these highway patrolmen violated a law or two.
You cannot falsify a report. You can't. And in your official capacity, if you go and make an official statement that something has happened, that's falsifying a report.
And, I know there are laws that apply to giving false information to a federal officer, like the FBI or something.
Right.
But is there anything that applies to a state police officer who gives false information to the public? Deliberately, knowingly, intentionally false information.
It would be nice to find out if that's there, but I want to say something about that. Let's just be absolutely honest here. What the officials do, they get away with. They get away with it. They can go in there. You're very clear and you're very correct. They could go in there and they can lie and they can upset all these people. But if one of the kids got a hold of the address system and did the very same thing, they would be expelled and probably would not be allowed back in the school. And
ever.
There would probably be some legal stuff, yeah. Now, if I was to go and say, I don't like this religious group, and then I tuck away the members of that religious group's kids, I could be jailed for that. You know, without justification, I could be jailed for it. But the state can do it and say, oh, we're doing it because we love the kids. The state can take a child away from parents who has had a complaint against them, unsubstantiated, that they've been sexually abusing a child, and the child may not have ever been touched, and they can put that child into a home where they're actually sexually abused, and there is no ramification. Official misconduct should be punishable by law.
Well, I'm sure you're familiar dealing with schools and such. You're familiar with the Latin phrase and the legal concept of in loco parentis, aren't you?
In loco parentis.
That means in the place of the parents.
Right. And the state is never a good parent.
But the thing is, most states, law holds that the state stands in loco parentis for the well-being of a child. That's what allows Children and Family Services to go pull children out of homes,
right,
where there are abusive situations.
And that's what allows them in school to make decisions for the parent while the kid's in school.
Because the school administration, the teachers, the school district stands in loco parentis during the time that the child is in the care, custody, and control of the school.
Except when something goes wrong, then they say, oh, well, we can't do that. Yeah, you're right. Legally, they are responsible.
And so you would think then, by extension, that anything that a parent could be charged with doing to a child, a member of the school board, and the school administration and the school district could be charged as well.
You would think.
So, for instance, if a concerned parent, let's say it's Mad Mothers Against Drunk Drivers or whatever, the local president of the chapter goes and does this on his or her own to the students without telling the school.
Right.
That would be a clear-cut case of intentional infliction of emotional distress and a clear-cut case of child abuse.
child abuse, and that person would be arrested. Plus, the police officers who are in, the fake police officers who are in uniforms would be arrested for impersonating a police officer. So, yes. Yeah. Now, if a police officer comes into the school and then gives you false information, to me, that's impersonating a police officer. But is anything going to be done?
No. No. No, we're just, you know, we're just talking to a few tens of thousands of people all over the world, and certainly not enough to make a stink at El Camino High School in somewhere near San Diego.
I'd like to have a few tens of thousands of people to write a few letters, but people don't seem to want to.
No, no.
I kind of lost the art on that.
But the here's the worst part. This is one of those cases of California sneezes and America gets the flu.
Mm-hmm.
And if these thugs are allowed to get away with this in this one school in California, it will, A, spread around California like wildfire, and the next thing you know, it'll be happening in Texas, it'll be happening in West Virginia.
Every fad starts in California.
And so we've, like I said, peoples at liberty do not do this. This is authoritarianism, isn't it, Rick?
Absolutely it is. There's no doubt about it. Because you cannot go into a school system and frighten half to death, and probably because there's going to be a suicide, frightened to death. Kids, for no reason. It's unforgivable. You know, they talk about a beep chip to keep horrible things off the TV, to keep the kids from seeing that. Where's the beep chip for the teachers, the administrators, for the cops? This is wrong, and it's done some damage. And if even one child has one nightmare, and there'll be more than that, the damage is going to stick for a while.
Yeah, it's long-term damage. It is long-term harm.
You know, you could probably get somebody who develops agoraphobia later who refuses to drive. And because they refuse to drive, they can't get a livelihood. Because they can't get a livelihood, and they're stuck in their house, and they refuse to drive because of the panic attack that was caused by this stupid trick, they die. Or they become completely cut off from their family and friends, emotionally die. There's an enormous amount of stuff. Some people start thinking, okay, Jerry died, okay, and this thing, so I'm not going to date him anymore. How many boyfriends and girlfriends are going to break up? There's a lot of issues that they hadn't even stopped to look at. And the one I'm thinking about the most is someone is going to be thinking, I'm offing myself. And now they know why they should, because everybody will be crying for them. It's going to happen.
Golly Moses. Well, Rick, thank you very kindly, my friend.
Well, sorry for cutting in here.
No. I wanted you to. I was conjuring you for all I was worth because I don't feel necessarily comfortable just sort of ad lib. You know, I'm not a psychologist, and I don't play one on the radio. You know what I mean?
Well, you should. Everybody else does.
God knows, Phil. Dr. Phil does.
God, I hate that bastard. Okay. I'm going to let you go, sir. I appreciate it.
Back to work for you, Rick.
Uh-huh.
Later. Bye now. Porn psychotherapist Rick Goodner. Calling from Texas. Well, there's a few minutes left in the program. Maybe about 15 minutes left in the program. You want to sound off on this, or is this just ho-hum another day in authoritarian fascist America to you? Should I have left this story alone? Am I thinking this is bigger than what it is? I guess I'm a minimalist. Because I see things like this that happen in one place, and I know that they're going to happen in another, because this is the kind of authoritarianism that spreads like a disease. And once again, I'm guilty of this. I always think, what would I do if somebody did this to my kids? And frankly, you wouldn't be able to, man, woman, don't care. You would not be able to pull me off that so-called guidance counselor. And I would be in jail before the night was out because I would have thrown a punch at the damn superintendent of schools. And I would have felt real good about doing it, too. Don't you ever, ever
do that to my child again. Of course, I know what the right-wing spin on this is. Ah, this is what you get in the government schools. They need to be homeschooled. They need to be learning that two and two is a miracle called five. They need to learn that just like good fundamentalist Jim Inhofe of Oklahoma, that Iraq is part of Africa. Now, see, that's not acceptable to me either. Get it right in the public schools. Get kids through 12 years of secondary education without deliberately screwing with their heads. But this is the kind of mind-warping that goes on in a fascist society. This is truly, in the every pure sense of the word, Orwellianism. Up is down, day is night, left is right, black is white, good is bad. Yeah, and you don't know who you can believe. That's what happened in the authoritarian societies behind the Iron Curtain. Everyone was encouraged to spy on everybody else. You know, we had one of those bills crop up somewhere along the way. I think Jim Sensenbrenner of Wisconsin sponsored it a couple of years ago, where people were encouraged to spy on their neighbors under the guise of national security. And so you make it such that a child doesn't know when to believe the teacher and when not to believe the teacher. When to know that they're having their head screwed with and when to wonder if their head is being screwed with and when, you know, are they actually telling me the truth this time? But I guess in many ways there's nothing new about that. You know, go back to the, this is your brain, egg cracks in a hot skillet. This is your brain on drugs. What? I'm going to smoke a joint and my brain's going to turn, is going to turn into a fried egg? Dude, are you going to eat that? Wow, I'm kind of hungry. And that's why the war on drugs is such a failure. Because it was not honest with the people it was trying to keep from trying so-called illegal substances. You know, there weren't any anti-drug commercials out there that said, listen, you know, later on when you're an adult, maybe you're going to try this and you're going to lay down in a field somewhere and you're going to feel like you're one with the universe and everything's going to make sense for, and then you're going to be really hungry. And it'll demotivate you and stuff like that, you know, and be careful and don't do this while you're a kid. Can't be that honest. You got to tell them, all right, your brain's going to turn into a fried egg, kid. Hey, kid. Your best friend was killed in a car wreck. See, I'm a cop. You can trust me. Ha ha. Joke's on you. See, here he is. And if other kids were actually, and they had to have been, because there were 20-some kids that they did this with, they had to be brought in on the ruse, too. Which means that they crapped all over their friends. Which means that maybe the authorities now know that they've got people who would be, you know, willing little stoolies. Oh, I think this story says a hell of a lot more about America than it were it simply some isolated incident. And you just know damned well that somebody out there, oh, yeah, that was a good idea. I can't wait till they bring it to my county. That's what our kids need to see in school. They need to be scared straight. Scared straight. Oh, what they need is some tough love. So that's what we do to our kids here in America. That's what we do to kids who are good kids, who aren't violating the rules, who are minding their own business, who are getting it right, getting ready to finish high school. You know, not the one-third of children who don't finish high school. The ones who actually put out the effort and then get all the way to the end, almost to having their hands on the diploma, and we mess with their heads. Oh, that's smart. But that's okay. At least these kids only had their heads screwed with, not their entire lives. Not like kids in Iraq. Not like, Haider Jassim Muhammad, who was selling tissues at an intersection where an IED went off in Baghdad.
He said, I was apprehended with seven others by American troops on suspicion of plotting the attack with insurgents and spent nearly 6 months in two prisons in Baghdad and Basra. He was accused of cooperating with the insurgents by notifying them about the convoy in the 2006 attack. The military couldn't prove it, and they eventually had to release him, but only after nearly 6 months of torture, degradation, and illegal incarceration. In May 2008, the Iraqi military said it had found six juveniles aged between 14 and 18 in the basement of an abandoned house in the northern city of Mosul. According to a military officer, the six juveniles were coerced into training by a Saudi militant. Oh, another nice Saudi. Who reportedly threatened to rape their mothers and sisters, destroy their houses, and kill their siblings if they failed to follow his orders. That's six on the tab of a rotten-ass Saudi. On the tab of the United States of America, you, me, we, the people of the United States, in order to form a more perfect union, you know, us. On our tab, since March 2003, the United States Army has detained 2,400 Iraqi children. Some of them as young as 10. This, according to Human Rights Watch. In a statement last month, Human Rights Watch said detention rates for children had risen drastically in 2007 to an average of, listen to this, 100 new cases a month from 25 a month in 2006. We are incarcerating more children and not less in Iraq. As of the 12th of May, 2008, the United States military has in its care, custody, and control, detention, and imprisonment, 513 Iraqi children classified as imperative threats to security. They are kept at the concentration camps, Camp Cropper in Baghdad, and Camp Buka near Basra. Children. There is no guarantee that they are treated as children. Young Muhammad said, they were taking my blanket or forcing me to sleep on the ground. I was able to see my mother only once during my detention period, in which no one interrogated me about the incident. They just grabbed him, warehoused him, and forgot him. This is what a fascist nation does. Clarissa Bencomo is a Middle Eastern children's researcher at Human Rights Watch. She said, in conflicts where it was not directly involved, the U.S. has been a leader in helping child soldiers re-enter society. That kind of leadership is unfortunately missing in Iraq. The vast majority of children detained in Iraq languish for months in U.S. military custody. And, as I said before, what that results in is the creation of another child who will grow into an adult who hates America, who hates Americans, and dreams of vengeance. Not because we have home mortgages, not because we have a better standard of living, but because we tormented their land, we killed their loved ones, and we imprisoned them in concentration camps. That is why they will hate America. And that is why, when somebody comes up and says, you know, hey, you really hate America? Oh, I really hate America. Good. Join the, you know, join the resistance. They will. And every time they see an American soldier inside a scope or within their sights, they will more joyfully pull the trigger because they will see a walking, breathing manifestation of the hell and horror that they were put through. Do the math. 513 children in American concentration camps in Iraq. Now, multiply it out. Does he have a mama? Does he have a daddy? Does he have brothers and sisters, cousins, aunts, uncles? You know, extended families are very, very important still in that part of the world, even if they're not important here in the United States anymore. And every last one of those people will be filled with an urge and a desire and a holy fire to exact some level of justice on us, and they will manifest it against the son or daughter of one of your neighbors. Because it's the only way they can, and they will continue to manifest it in that way until such time as we get the common good sense to get the hell out. And that, of course, will not happen under John Sidney McCain III. Because he says, troops in Iraq really don't matter. Hell of a way to end a show, but that's how it ends. Thanks, everybody, for joining in. Thank you, those of you who stand with us, shoulder to shoulder, in the trenches, fighting the right-wing hate and the right-wing filth, trying to bring a few facts, trying to bring a little common sense to the world. One person, one new listener at a time, if we have to. Thank you. Thank you to Ben Birch, the hardest working man in liberal talk at whiterosesociety.org. He has a fundraiser going on. He needs your help as much as we do here. Thanks to our IT professional, Peter Godbold, on his way with a very special brand new edition of Strictly Confidential, the world's most fabulous LGBT conversation radio program. Thank you to John Fox, our chief engineer. He's on his way with All Foxed Up, the lead-in to the weekend edition, because this is his Friday right now. That's coming your way at midnight Eastern time. In between Strictly Confidential and All Foxed Up, of course, the horn section, my favorite hour of the evening, quite frankly, when Peter and John and I and any other horn host who cares to join in are free to sit down at the round table and improv and ad-lib and just take it straight off the cuff for a solid hour. I hope you'll stick around for all of that. Thank you to the hardest working, bravest people I know at Coal River Mountain Watch, crmw.net. For a very small amount of money, you can join Coal River Mountain Watch and you can become a part of the solution that saves all of us. For we are all downstream from mountaintop removal. That saves all of us. And always, 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 RMR, Gina, it's all for you.